Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Untold histories and unreported stories or underreported stories find their way to us in many ways. On today's Project Censored Show, we're going to look at the significance and the importance of film as one of those vehicles to tell untold or underheard stories. Today, we'll look at the 17th Oakland International Film Festival. The Oakland International Film Festival is an annual showcase of independent films from around the world, including films made in Oakland. Held in various venues in the city of Oakland, the International Film Festival consists of film screenings, workshops, panels, and special events. Our guests today are part of the Oakland International Film Festival. We'll be joined by journalist J.R. Valerie. He's on the advisory board and is a publicist for the Oakland International Film Festival. And then we are going to be speaking with one of the filmmakers, Adam Dubin. The film that he has in the film festival this year is an untold history, all right, a cultural story, Murder in the Front Row, the San Francisco Bay Area thrash metal story. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are going to highlight the 17th Oakland International Film Festival. The dates for that are September 19th to the 29th. The website for the Oakland International Film Festival is oiff.org. And we're joined today by a member of the Film Festival Advisory Board, who is also a fellow independent journalist, has written for The Bayview, also written books, and is a broadcast journalist as well. J.R. Valerie, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you for having me, Mickey. I'm Project Censored. I'm a fan.
Well, J.R., we certainly have known your work at the Project for some time, including with the San Francisco Bayview, and it was really great to hear from you earlier in the summer that you've been working with the Oakland International Film Festival, and I want to thank you for reaching out to us to cover some of the very important and undercovered topics that are going on at the film festival. Just again, so folks know, speaking with J.R. Valerie on the board at the Oakland International Film Festival, this is the 17th annual. The mission of the festival says to promote independent films and the filmmakers that make them. The Oakland International Film Festival is an annual showcase of independent films from around the world, including films made in Oakland. Typically held at various venues in the city of Oakland, the Oakland International Film Festival consists of film screenings, workshops, panels, special events, and parties. Additionally, throughout the year, the Oakland Film Society hosts various networking events, screenings to keep Oakland engaged with the independent film community and the stories they tell. And J.R. Valerie, given that you are a journalist and you are connected now here to the film festival, can you tell our listeners about some of the stories that they're telling this year?
My role in the film festival, as well as being on the advisory committee, is also as a publicist. So I get a chance to see a lot of the films. Some of my favorites this year is definitely Lalo's House. Lalo's House is a film based in Haiti. It's about a Christian orphanage, or I should say a front that acts as a Christian orphanage, when it really is a place where there are human trafficking the children. In light of the Jeffrey Epstein, the Harvey Weinstein, the R. Kelly, all of that stuff, we need to see this film. We need to become more aware of what's happening with people, not just in Haiti, but also in Haiti and all around the world, but also right here in Oakland, right here in the Bay Area, right here in Northern California. Another one of my favorites is Unalienable Rights. It is a half animation, I want to call it a documentary slash half told in animation. It's a great film. It's a 14-minute short. What I like about it, it's a historical piece. Some of it is footage from the MOVE police invasion in 1978. And other parts of it, like foreshadows, it gives you the backstory. So you hear from people like Mumia Abu-Jamal, the political prisoner, who I'm sure, and I know the Project Censor crowd knows who that is. He's in the film. John Africa, who's the head of MOVE, and a number of other people. Decade of Fire is another film. It's told from a Puerto Rican resident of the Bronx perspective. It is a 1 hour long narrative. It's a documentary, and it's talking about how the landlords basically in the 70s were burning people out of the Bronx so that they can make way for higher income residents, much like what's going on in much of California. Also, in light of the upcoming rent bill, that's something that should be very interesting for people to see, to know the history of what landlords are capable of in the United States, what the history has been and what the history of resistance has been. Murder in the Front Row, which people are going to hear about later on in this show, which is a film about the music scene, the rock scene, the metal scene right here in the Bay Area and in Northern California. A lot of big favorites are there, and we're proud to say that Mickey Huff is going to be hosting the Q&A with the filmmaker. Another one of my favorites is My Father, Belize. It's a film based in Belize that is about a son who has issues with his father who had just passed, but also learns on the trip where he's trying to reconcile with his father's memory, learns that he has a son that has been born in Belize. He basically is put in his father's shoes instantly. And he also learns other aspects and other secrets of the family. It's a family-oriented, family secret, something that I think is emotionally gripping because it's something that a lot of families deal with. And, you know, the film festival is not just about political issues, but personal issues, family issues. And the last one I'm going to talk about is Tent City. With the amount of homelessness that's going on around California in Los Angeles right now, and you have Skid Row that's huge. You have Oakland that's huge, has a huge homeless population. San Francisco has a huge homeless population. And Tent City is the story of a family that basically is outpriced and a father and daughter who has to deal with homelessness. And basically a daughter sees her father disintegrate in front of her eyes because of the mental health issues that homelessness itself creates. So, you know, that's about 6-7 movies right there. Those were some of my favorites, Mickey, that were showing this year that I saw. I saw probably about 60% of the films, but those were some of the greatest ones that I liked.
Well, J.R. Valerie, you know, again, I appreciate not only your sharing that, but, you know, you shared some of these with me. Certainly Murder in the Front Row was one of them. We'll be talking to the director, the producer, Adam Dubin, later on in the program, as you pointed out. You know, some other ones, of course, on the list, if you want to go to OIFF.org, the Oakland International Film Festival, you can see more. We're speaking with independent journalist J.R. Valerie. He is also on the advisory board and does publicity work for the Oakland International Film Festival. The Alternative Facts, The Lies of Executive Order 9066 jumped off the list. I've yet to see that film, but there are so many films on the list here. You said that are both personal and political. And that leads me to the next question. With, at least in my mind, what situates you fairly uniquely to be involved in this cultural festival? Your work as an independent journalist and the work that you did with the San Francisco Bayview newspaper, the kind of stories that you write and the stories that you tell. Could you talk to our listeners a little bit about how that background has also attuned you to do so many other things like you're doing right now, film festival?
Well, I think the work that I've done with the San Francisco Bayview, the work that I'm doing right now with Black Report TV and I did with Black Report Radio, it's about telling people stories. And I think that the film festival is about telling stories in all kinds of different ways, from fictional accounts that have historical tidbits, to historical films, to straight fictional films. And I think that every film that I've seen and that I've liked has a theme. And they're trying to get across a message. And that's the thread that I see. I love storytelling. And I love the fact how people can be educated and we can be brought to a higher consciousness. Not just in our minds, but in our actions, through just the images that we're exposed to. And the fact that you're giving the Oakland International Film Festival an opportunity to speak on your platform that helps to bring your listeners to the film festival. And the ones that don't even come, that just makes them aware that they may come in a following year. But my point in saying that is to say that's what creates community. That's what creates a higher consciousness, a knowledge, education. We have a political education. I mean, I see it as a political education platform. I'm talking about the festival. And I see it as cultural education. I see it as geographic education. We're seeing lands that most of us will never travel to. I mean, there's a beauty in it. It's not a strict regimented education that you're forced to get from a school system. This is an education where you can see what you want in the films, and in a lot of cases you can have an interaction with the filmmaker right then and there, and you can ask that question that you can't ask the director's cut. You can't ask the little documentary that they do right before the film. So we try to create and make film real. But the fact that I'm a journalist, I try to look at new ways to tell the story. I don't want to tell the story in an antiquated way when people aren't accepting information in the same way that they were accepting it in the 50s. How can we tell the story the same way? Technology is different. People's lifestyles are different. Current events are different. And I think that we have to be relatable when we are trying to educate people. They have to be able to relate to the story. And I think that the Oakland International Film Festival has been one of the biggest festivals, or I should say events, that has given me a wide array of knowledge on a wide array of subjects and topics, some that I was interested in before, but some that I didn't even know I was interested in. And so that's one of the beauties of the festival.
Yeah, J.R. Valerie, I couldn't agree more. And I think, again, you explained really well how your work as a journalist and a community journalist, especially a bottom-up journalist, someone that isn't afraid to not only tell the tough stories in the places where even alternative media and independent media sometimes aren't looking, but you're also not afraid to let other people, you know, do the talking in their own voices. You know, and I like the way that you describe to us what goes on at the film festival. It's an incredibly diverse offering of culture, of arts, I would argue in terms of documentary, of journalism. There's a lot going on. And I think that a lot of the listeners here on just KPFA and Pacifica, but the stations around the country, I know some people aren't in the Oakland area, of course, that listen to this show. But this show, to me, and JR, you reminded me of this too again this summer, saying, like, you know, a lot of communities have film festivals that people could be deeply involved in that tell the stories that are going on, even right in their own backyards, from global to local and back again. And again, I just really appreciate that you wanted to remind folks, particularly our audience, right, at Project Censored, the news that doesn't make the news, and a lot of the topics in these documentaries and a lot of these films, even if they're fiction, they're things that are sometimes difficult to discuss and things that we never really see. Certainly not in the corporate media, but sometimes not even in the independent press. And OIFF.org is the website. And J.R. Valerie, anything else you'd like to add here about the festival? We certainly want to encourage people, and we're going to post information when we air the show here. We're going to definitely post information on social media, and we're going to try to get as many people as possible to go. There's so many different days. I mean, it's from September 19 to 29. So, of course, you can't go to everything, but there's a hip-hop festival. Inside of this, there's parties, gatherings, as well as films and shorts of all different styles. So, J.R. Valerie, anything else you want to add for our listeners here about the great work you're doing with the Oakland International Film Festival?
First, I just want to, again, thank you. But I also want to just offer tickets. I mean, Murder in the Front Row sold out. It was the first screening to sell out at the Oakland International Film Festival. And so we're adding another screen. And so we want to offer 3 pairs of tickets, and we also want to say thank you for hosting the Q&A. You will be hosting the Q&A. And so we're asking and inviting all of Project Censored audience that are interested in cinema to come through, hang out with us, and, you know, let's talk, let's network, let's talk about these stories and the different things that different people see in the movie that I may not have caught. So, again, Mickey, thank you, and thank you to Project Censored.
So J.R. Valerie, Block Report Radio, now Block Report TV, independent journalist and also writer with San Francisco Bayview, also on the advisory board and doing publicity work for the Oakland International Film Festival. You can learn more at oiff.org. And J.R. Valerie, before I let you go, can you give any online places for people to follow you or follow more of your work?
Block Report TV on YouTube is the newest, is what I'm doing now, and I'm about to develop more of a political platform called The Whirlwind, but it's still under construction. But Block Report TV, you can see interviews from the film festival as well as cultural, more cultural type stuff. But I'm still at the Bayview. I'm doing more film type work. I'm working on a book called Off Script that's about interviewing filmmakers about stuff like this, like what we're doing right now. It should be out towards the end of the year or the beginning of next year. And I'm on SoundCloud. I'm on Facebook. So check me out on SoundCloud, Block Report Radio. And on Facebook, I'm under my name, J.R. Valray. Or you could check out Block Report Radio on Facebook. But again, thank you for the opportunity, Mickey.
J.R., thanks so much. You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. After this musical break, we'll continue our program. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we have a very special guest that's going to talk to us about his work on, I wouldn't necessarily say uncovering, but rather platforming and highlighting a very, very significant part of the cultural history, actually of the world these days, but siphoning it all the way back down to the East Bay in San Francisco, California, to the 1980s. It would be sort of a history of what became known as the thrash metal scene in the heavy metal universe. And we're going to have a really interesting conversation, and I think it's going to be sociological and historical, and I'm really sure that we're going to get into a lot of really interesting things here. Adam Dubin is a graduate of the New York Film Program. He's co-directed the classic Beastie Boys music videos, Fight for Your Right to Party and No Sleep Till Brooklyn. In the late 1990s, MTV, when they actually showed music videos, voted Fight for Your Right to Party the number one comedy music video of all time. In 2001, TV Guide included Fight for Your Right to Party in their list of 50 greatest music videos of all time. Adam Dubin directed the multi-platinum selling A Year and a Half in the Life of Metallica, Parts 1 and 2, feature-length documentaries for Metallica and the music video Nothing Else Matters. Adam has directed several short comedy films with comedians Lewis Black and Jim Norton, and he is working also on a documentary about John Lennon in New York City. But the reason that we're talking to Adam Dubin today is because of a film that he worked on based on a book of the same name called Murder in the Front Row. It's part of the Oakland International Film Festival. So again, our program, the Project Censored Show, airs out of KPFA, the historic station in Berkeley, California, the East Bay, neighboring city to Oakland, California. I'll be giving more information about the Oakland Film Festival later on in the program. But right now, I want to get into this conversation with Adam Dubin. Adam, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you, Mickey. I'm so happy to be here with you. Thank you.
Given that our program's on a lot of progressive and community radio stations, I'm sure some listeners right now are saying, "Murder in the Front Row. What's going on? Who's taking over?" Right now, Adam Dubin, I want you to take over the microphone because I want you to talk about what exactly is this film that you've made about and what really propelled you to tell this really significant cultural story of the San Francisco Bay Area thrash metal scene?
Murder in the Front Row. The full title is Murder in the Front Row, the San Francisco Bay Area thrash metal story. I just put that all on there, that tag, because if I just said Bay Area, I mean, everybody there knows what that means. But, you know, go to another country or someplace, right, and be like, what bay? Which bay?
Which one?
You know, Green Bay, Wisconsin. And it's basically a story of thrash metal coming together in the San Francisco Bay Area. But much of this activity really centers around the East Bay, where a lot of this activity and young bands coming together, where they got going at clubs like Ruthie's Inn and others. So I'm really proud that the film is being screened at the Oakland International Film Festival, because that really is the home of where this film should be in terms of connecting with a lot of the activity that was there. And indeed, a lot of the players, the musicians that created this music, were East Bay people. And you know, two of the most significant are Gary Holt, who's Exodus and Slayer, and Kirk Hammett, who is Exodus and Metallica, of course. East Bayers down to the bone, down to the core. So the film started as a book, and the book is basically a photo book, more photos than text. And it was put together by two guys, Brian Liu and Harold Oyman. Both of them were in the San Francisco Bay Area thrash scene, and they were there from day one. I mean, it wasn't even called thrash when those guys were first going to it. And of course, nobody was documenting this. It was not like on the radar of any mainstream media of any kind. You know, the mainstream rock press or any other press wasn't really paying attention. In fact, the press in the San Francisco area was not even paying attention. So bands were forming. Exodus was playing around. Metallica came to town and they were playing. Slayer came to town, they were playing. And the interesting story there was, of course, that Metallica and Slayer did not find a great audience for what they were doing in the Los Angeles area where they were formed, but they found a terrific audience in the Bay Area. So the Bay Area just kind of got this fast, this new fast music that was kind of a combination of punk and metal and just put on steroids and speeded up. So Harold and Brian put together a book. It came out some years ago by this title, Murder in the Front Row, and I'll explain where the title comes from. And Brian gave me the book, and I was just knocked out by it. I mean, the pictures are just so real, and you could feel the sweat and the heat of the clubs. And if anybody has had that experience of going to a club and seeing a band where it's loud and your ears are ringing and like it's hot as hell, wherever you've done that in the world, you'll identify with the pictures in this book. It really just tells the story very powerfully. So this really grabbed me, and I realized that the pictures are great, but the full story behind the pictures wasn't really told in the book. There was more to tell. And so I got with Brian and Harold and really unraveled from them a lot about the scene. And then, of course, I had to start my archaeology, going back and talking to the right people and digging to find out what went on and get this kind of collective thought process, which is the documentary. That's basically how that came to be.
Right. Well, Adam Dubin, that's a great place to start. So let's go back even further. And, you know, I want to get a little bit into some of the political roots here. Naturally, we could certainly go back, and I mean, we don't need to go all the way back to rhythm and blues and the influence of African-American music and so forth on the rise of what's later called rock and roll, and the fusion of many styles, like you said, between rock and punk rock, as it was coming out of the 1970s. Of course, in England, in working class community, we had the birth of, you know, Tony Iommi, who lost the tips of several fingers in an industrial accident, right, who becomes one of the riffing gurus, forerunners of what becomes known as heavy metal. And the reason I just wanted to bring that up, and of course, Tony Iommi is the guitar player for Black Sabbath, Ozzy Osbourne, Geezer Butler, etc. These come out of working class communities. And a lot of that follows over to the United States. And I know I'm skipping over some big part of that history here, but I want to get back to the Bay Area. A lot of the folks that you were just mentioning, they also came from these kinds of working class backgrounds. And a lot of these bands, their music was very aggressive. It was angst-driven. It seemed to exhibit degrees of anxiety, alienation. You already mentioned that even the rock and roll music press ignored the metal scene or derided the metal scene. And it was mocked even by MTV for a very, very long time until it became commodified. And we can maybe get into that later. But, you know, the politics of heavy metal is often seriously misunderstood, over-exaggerated in a way that it is not progressive, and somehow that it is not inclusive, and somehow there's not really any positive messaging that goes on there. And of course, as someone myself who's an historian and as well as a musician and who grew up playing this kind of music with heavy neoclassical roots, heavy metal music is actually not only sophisticated musically, but the messaging is very important, and it tells a story from the bottom up that a lot of other genres and a lot of other parts of our culture were simply ignoring. Could you talk a little bit about that, Adam Dubin?
Yeah, absolutely. As you look at these musical genres as they develop, it really does come out of working class backgrounds. And again, that brings it back to, it's not really a surprise that if you know some history that the East Bay is involved here. What you have in San Francisco Bay Area is you have a melting pot, for sure, for generations. As I looked at this, and if you watch the beginning of the movie, we very quickly mention that other scenes have started out here. So this is by no means the first scene in San Francisco. The most obvious one, of course, is the psychedelic rock scene of the 60s. But you could go back and you have the Beat Generation, Jack Kerouac and everybody. They had the freedom in San Francisco Bay Area to meet and speak and have shows. Yeah.
Lawrence Ferlinghetti founded City Lights Books in San Francisco. So that's the heart of the whole Beat movement.
No accident that it was there, because you could support that bookshop there. Another town wouldn't support it. And so you go back further, and the reason the Beats were there is because the jazz was there. The Beat poets did not listen to rock and roll. They listened to bebop jazz. And so you go back further, and that was a scene that is heavily supported by the San Francisco Bay Area. And indeed, that's why I started the movie. I felt it was appropriate to start the movie with a quote from Jack Kerouac, because I wanted to connect the dots directly to what I saw in the photographs and ultimately in the documentation, is that you had young people creating a scene for themselves, connected to other things. I mean, they were inspired by other things, but certainly created it. And it was, to me, it was a direct line, not just to heavy metal, which is obvious, but it's a direct line through Black Sabbath, even earlier than that, back to jazz and the blues and the Beats. It's all one line. So it is no accident that heavy metal, which was created, you know, it's usually put forth that the first true heavy metal band was Black Sabbath. Well, Black Sabbath didn't come out of London, and they didn't come out of Liverpool. They came out of Birmingham, working class Birmingham. And as Ozzy and Tony have said, and others who came out of there, that your choices were very few as a young person in Birmingham. You were probably going to go to work in factory work. That was the choice for a young person, unless you picked up an instrument and did something different. And so I think when we watch Murder in the Front Row, the first person who starts to talk about this is Kirk Hammett, who was growing up in El Sobrante and said that he was just a kid who was bored and there wasn't really much to do. And I don't think he saw a future for himself in which he could do well, really. You know, he didn't sound like he was college-oriented or going to be in a profession that would launch him. And here he got interested in music, but not any music. He didn't pick music that's like commercial that you could go play and like earn a living as a musician. Kirk Hammett picked the edge of music. He was listening to bands from Europe that inspired him, and then he wanted to play like those bands. And it was hard music and fast music. And so before Metallica even forms, Kirk Hammett forms Exodus in the East Bay and recruits other members who are still in the band to this day, guys like Tom Hunting and Gary Holt, and they start playing this hard-edged music. And I think it's just a real testament to how strong that desire was to escape in that way through the music. And when I talk about that, I could be saying a story that is exactly the same as why Muddy Waters picked up a guitar, or why Sonny Rollins played saxophone, or whatever. It wasn't just to earn a living. I mean, they were out there on the edge of what was being done and blazing a new trail with it. And I think that, to me, is the similarity of those musicians and the cutting edge of what they were trying to do musically.
Of course, another couple bands coming out of the Bay Area: Legacy, Testament, Alex Skolnick, Eric Peterson. I'd like to remind listeners right now that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show, and we're talking to Adam Dubin. The filmmaker has actually done a lot of music video work with Beastie Boys, actually did documentaries with Metallica. And we're talking about a new film based on a snapshot book, a photo book that came out in 2012. But the film is called Murder in the Front Row. It's now screening coming up here at the 17th Oakland International Film Festival. That's between September 19 and 29. The film will be showing in the evening of September 26th, and we're going to have Adam Dubin talk to us a little bit more about what might be going on there. But right now, we're going to take a musical break, and then we're going to come back and continue our conversation with Adam Dubin, and we're going to talk about the title of this film to explain some of the context culturally. Please stay with us. Tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Welcome back. On today's program, we're doing something a little bit different. We're talking about the cultural history of the East Bay in California as manifest through the heavy metal, thrash heavy metal scene. We're speaking with the filmmaker and artist Adam Dubin. The film is called Murder in the Front Row. It's going to be screening at the Oakland International Film Festival. I'll be giving you more details about that later, and Adam Dubin, our guest, can talk to you a little bit more about it. And Adam Dubin, of course, has a long history going back to the 90s, NYU Film School, made award-winning videos with the Beastie Boys, documentaries with Metallica. Really perfectly situated in a lot of ways, even though, Adam Dubin, you're in New York. And interestingly, we're talking about the significant roots culturally of the rise of what we now know as the modern or contemporaneous heavy metal world that is a global phenomenon. But a lot of the roots for that, a big, big influence, is the San Francisco Bay Area, the East Bay in particular, up and down the I-80 corridor. That's obviously something that connects us, right? The I-80 corridor from coast to coast. But tell us about the name of the film, because I'm sure some people listening in the audience here aren't necessarily fans of metal and may not really get metal culture. And that's really why I wanted to have you on to help talk about that. The film is called Murder in the Front Row. And of course, those are lyrics, Paul Bailoff, Gary Holt, going back to an Exodus song on the first record, Bonded by Blood. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Murder in the Front Row. It's a fearsome title. But it's actually a very, very cool movie. I think people are surprised by how interested they are. I've heard people come up to me and said, you know, I don't really care for this genre of music, but I was fascinated because it's really told from the perspective of people building something. And you don't have to love the music. In fact, there's not a ton of the music in terms of playing it in there. It's really more a discussion of how and who built this scene and personal stories from that scene. The title comes from the song Bonded by Blood, which is from the album of the same name. It is the first album by the band Exodus. Exodus was started by Kirk Hammett, but Kirk Hammett left a few years later, very famously, to join Metallica, replacing Dave Mustaine. But Exodus stayed together, the lead guitar player for that being Gary Holt, who is not just in Exodus, but also in Slayer now. And Murder in the Front Row was the title. There's a person who was the lead singer of Exodus. He's no longer with us, unfortunately, and we address that in the movie. But his name was Paul Bailoff, and I never knew Paul, but Paul, by all accounts, was a rock and roll wild man and actually a very nice guy. If you know, people got to know him, said he was very warm and, you know, loved his friends and everybody loved him. But I mean, on stage, he was second to none. And he would call out, for instance, he would call out, "Posers must die." And he would like talk about killing posers. Now, part of this is with a wink and a nod. That was Paul's way. And I think he did what any great frontman does, which is rev up the crowd, get people interested. So a frontman has to do a little patter in between songs, and Paul would do that, you know, and he would keep everybody fired up. And then he'd go into one of his songs. And one of those songs was Bonded by Blood. And in the lyrics, there's a line, "Murder in the front row, blood upon the stage," is the next part of the lyric. So that lyric comes from something that actually happened. Bonded by Blood, the whole album, is really very much a documentary of the scene that Exodus and the other headbangers of that time were living in. And so what happened was, Gary Holt tells the story that there was a band that was playing before Exodus one night at Ruthie's Inn. Probably the best way to describe it is Ruthie's Inn was like the CBGBs of the Bay Area scene.
Yes.
It was like the centerpiece where all the bands, if you came through the Bay Area as a thrash band, or, and I'll point out, or as a punk band, you would come through and play Ruthie's. And I'll get into a side note about that later, about who booked Ruthie's, because that's a great story in itself. But staying with this, a band was playing before Exodus, and they left their drink glasses on the front of the stage. It was apparently a much more tame type of band than Exodus. And then Exodus's audience came on. Exodus starts playing, and all the drink glasses got smashed. And suddenly there was broken glass and people stage diving and carrying on the stage. So people start getting cut, bleeding on the stage. There was blood upon the stage. That's not enough for Paul Baloff. Paul Baloff reaches down, gets a handful of this blood. I mean, this is all not very health conscious, I would say. But I would say in the heat of the moment of rock and roll, he was taken upon him to put his hand in it and just smear the blood down the face of this girl who had been there for the other band. And he just wiped it on her and she ran out screaming, and that inspired this lyric. Paul, I guess, got carried away with the moment. So it got into the lyrical content of what they were doing. So Murder in the Front Row, it describes the craziness and intensity of those early shows.
Adam Dubin, doesn't it also metaphorically, you know, it says Murder in the Front Row, a crowd begins to bang and there's blood on the stage, bang your head against the stage, and metal takes its price, bonded by blood. That also speaks to a subcultural fraternity, a large group of younger people. Of course, it is true that it seemed to be largely male, white male dominant in that regard. But this is also a group of people that felt that society was really passing them by and looking down at them quite disparagingly. And rather than take it sitting down, or rather, by the way, than being literally violent, not on the stage, on the streets, they took it through an art form and they expressed this kind of frustration, not just in a very creative way, but I would argue, as somebody myself that grew up in the Rust Belt in Western Pennsylvania and working class communities, I discovered this music through my dad, through my friends. One of my really great friends growing up, interestingly, we both escaped the greater Pittsburgh area, and I'm out on the left coast, and he actually went on to be the monitor engineer for Metallica. He works for them now, my good friend Bob Cowan. But for us growing up, this is another reason why this is kind of, you know, is personal for me in many ways, is that it, not only was it a refuge for us, an outlet for alienation, but I picked up guitar and started playing it very seriously at the age of 12 and 13 and got into classical music and classical fusion. And just to be honest, it was a fraternity. And even if I didn't always understand or agree with the metaphorical nature of some of the lyrics, there was definitely a language being spoken that carried me through a lot of difficult and tough times growing up where I did. And so when I talk about how these people were providing an outlet for alienation, it wasn't just for them and people that were there. And you know this too, Adam Dubin, these records were not easy to find. This music was not easy to find. It was commercially shut out. You had to seek it out. People would drive 50, 60, 70, 100 miles to get to Pittsburgh, to get to Cleveland, to get to a bigger city somewhere where you could maybe not only see a band, the big British bands, you know, Judas Priest, Iron Maiden, even though no one had heard of them, they were selling out major arenas. But you could go to these smaller clubs, Shadows, and these other places in Cleveland and see a Hallows Eve or see an early Megadeth, see some of these bands. And you would trade tapes with people and trade stories with people, and you really felt like you had some kind of connectivity to people. And even though externally, societally, a lot of what went on in heavy metal looked very negative, it actually was a very, very positive and uplifting experience for a lot of the people that were living it fraternally in this bonded by blood metaphor.
You said a mouthful of things, Mickey, and it's great. And we start the movie with taking everybody back to when they were young people searching out music. And a number of people talk about how they rode buses and trains and spent hours getting to these few record stores that carried the kind of records and magazines from Europe and elsewhere that they were looking for. But more importantly, what started to happen was it became a meeting place. You would see somebody else there who had patches on their jacket and whatever, and you would just start to talk because it was a community of people and they identified to each other. And I think that was going on in a lot of places, probably just as equally around the Pittsburgh area. You had to seek out your music. And it's funny how that is such a direct line, because it's like, if you know anything about the early history of the Rolling Stones, that's how Mick and Keith met. It's exactly how they met, seeking out blues records that were hard to find in England. So it's sort of a similar kind of idea, and it's a much different idea than you would have now with the ubiquity of the internet, where things could be found a lot easier. So that's one aspect to what you said. It's what I found in doing this research and interviewing people is that the thing that bound everybody together in the scene was a great camaraderie. I found it to be very open, as long as you were a fan of the music. In other words, I didn't find it to be any one type of person. I actually found it to be very diverse. It was probably more male. Yes, that's true. But it was not a white bread scene or something. It was just very diverse and mixed. And it seemed that the only card of entry was that you loved the music and that you knew the music. And what I found was, and you know, they were young ladies then, and they talked to us now, and they were in the scene, and it was like a brotherhood and a sisterhood. They were part of it. And if you look in the photographic record of everybody, it's a very diverse group of people. I think that it was just open to all, as long as you cared about the music. That was it. And it seems like Paul Bailoff was very much a gatekeeper of caring about the music.
I do remember those days and that kind of protective scene, but internally too, in terms of the fraternity. When you went to these places and when people would, you know, get into the so-called mosh pit and the circle pits, you know, when people fell over or ran into each other, they picked each other up. It wasn't about pummeling people. It was about being together and going through something and experiencing it together. And again, I think that what you do in the film really threads that together, that whole feeling, actually. And, you know, you did a great job of just allowing so many of these different players, these different characters, and also the fans. And the players were the fans, and the fans were the players. Can you talk a little bit about that egalitarianism of metal?
Exactly. I think what is very significant about this scene, this Bay Area thrash scene, is that, you know, it has to be noted that the players of the music, the musicians, and the people viewing it, the supporters, were really the same age. It was very different than if they bought a ticket to go see one of the bands coming around, like Judas Priest or something, which is a great band, but Judas Priest, you couldn't get to. They were, you know, at least a generation older, maybe not a full generation, but certainly older than the kids buying tickets. And you couldn't really talk to them. I mean, you could see them and you could enjoy them. These bands were their bands, and they were all each other's bands. So you have a photograph in the film of a young James Hetfield. And this is what interested me about the movie, about doing this movie, is that you have an 18-year-old James Hetfield playing for 18-year-olds, maybe 17 and 16-year-olds too, but basically the same age, and they're all one. And that is something that fascinated me, to go back in time to a time when a lot of these people, and, you know, Mustaine might have been a year or two older, but not much. And they could all hang out. They would all go have beers and just hang out afterward. You were not dealing with unattainable rock stars. And again, I'm not sure that any of these folks, I mean, they all wanted to be successful as musicians because they didn't want to do something else, and they were good at their craft. But I've always said that if Dave Mustaine or Kirk Hammett, or let's say even an Alex Skolnick, if they wanted to make money in music, they probably would have picked a much more poppy and accessible kind of music, but they didn't. These folks were riding the edge and actually, you know, breaking new boundaries. So I think that this collective, that's what was so important about the scene. It supported these musicians as they were starting out. They needed that. Bands like Metallica and other bands, bands like Possessed, who were teenagers in high school still, they needed that, that they could actually go to a club, book a club and play and build their band, and they're not even out of high school, and get a record deal. I mean, that's like amazing that they could do that. And it's not unheard of. I mean, it's happened, but it's amazing that they could play these shows and be supported, and that supported a guy. And now Larry Lalonde has had a lifetime of being a musician, and guys like Rob Flynn could form a band and Phil Demmel form a band.
Machine Head, Violence, and they're back. That's all San Francisco Bay Area. You mentioned Lalonde, and of course, that's also goes into Primus, Les Claypool, also Northern California. I mean, again, it's such a rich cultural heritage of this kind of music that comes out of the San Francisco Bay Area. It's really pretty amazing. And I think that that's what's also great about the fact that your film, Murder in the Front Row, is going to be screened at the Oakland International Film Festival on September 26th. People can learn more at the OIFF.org website. The film festival is September 19 to 29, and day 8 of the festival at the Jack London Regal Theater 1. That's Thursday, September 26th. Murder in the Front Row will screen 8:45 p.m. according to the schedule. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacific Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are listening to a filmmaker who has a film in the Oakland International Film Festival on a history of Bay Area thrash metal. And it is a sociological and cultural expose of a movement that went worldwide. Stay tuned after this musical break, and we'll continue our conversation with Adam Dubin. Listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On this week's episode, we are highlighting the Oakland International Film Festival, and specifically, we're talking with filmmaker, director Adam Dubin about Murder in the Front Row, OIFF.org, to learn more about the Oakland International Film Festival. And I'm planning to be there, and you were kind enough, Adam Dubin, to connect me with someone that was actually a part of that scene. Could you talk about her?
Connie Taylor is one of the original people in the scene. She was there for all of the shows and saw countless shows at Ruthie's Inn, and was one of the people that would house sit for Metallica. So this brings up that Metallica at the time had the famous, now infamous, Metallica Mansion in El Cerrito. Yeah, look at that. They live right there in East Bay, right up the street from Ruthie's Inn. And Metallica, of course, while they were identified as a San Francisco band, and indeed by half a year after moving to the Bay Area, they were already 50% a Bay Area band, but they didn't spend as much time there because basically they started to get so big so fast that they were away a lot of the time. That's what people don't realize, is that they were in Europe much of the time touring. And so there was two young ladies who watched the house for them, made sure that everything was okay. And of course, by watch the house meant a lot of the house parties started to happen at the Metallica Mansion without Metallica being there. And one of them was Connie, and she was great. And she's in the film, and she's offered to step up and introduce the film and I guess talk to you a bit, Mickey. And I just think it's great because, again, it just shatters the stereotype of this being an all-male experience and everything, because Connie was there, and she was at all these shows and respected. And there was a real sisterhood of a lot of great young ladies who were part of the scene. And you can see them in the photographic record. They're there, and it's just a great open scene. So that's going to be going on at the Oakland International Film Festival.
And it's, again, important to emphasize, you know, that these were, you know, a lot of young men and women that were really connected in a way that was outside of what was seen, the cultural norms. I mean, this was a subculture that went global in a lot of ways. And I think Brian Posen does the narration. He's in the San Francisco Bay Area.
That was one of the things when we decided to make Murder in Front Row, is that it would only be a first-person storyline. There was nobody who wasn't there or had some direct connection to it would be in there. So, I mean, by being in it, what I'm saying is we interviewed people in Europe and stuff, but those are people who got tapes from people in the Bay Area. So they were contemporary and involved in their own way. Brian Posehn is a very well-known comedian, and he's also very well-known for loving Metallica and Slayer and Megadeth. He was there for those early shows. He's from north of the Bay, I think not too far from Sacramento. He grew up. But he started going to Bay Area shows, you know, right then when they were happening, like Ruthie's and other shows. Day on the Green, when Metallica played very significantly in August of 1985. And Brian Posehn easily could have been an interview subject in the film, but we kind of held him back, and he made for a really great narrator for the film to be like our through line and voice to carry us through. And I'm so happy and proud that he's part of it, as is he. I mean, it was a great experience. So that's another East Bay connection there.
So Adam Dubin, we want to wrap up the segment. I know that you're really busy and you're going to be heading off to Europe and do some screenings. But a last note here that I wanted to remind listeners particularly is that a lot of folks that aren't into the scene or into this kind of music, whatever, it has a different stereotype attached to it than one might actually see when they're in the scene. So many of these bands and so much of this music is anti-racist. It's pro-environmental. I mean, Exodus grew up in the shadows of the Richmond refinery and had a song called Chemikill. And Megadeth, you know, notoriously political songs against the PMRC, music censorship, and so forth. Like right out of Frank Zappa in a lot of ways. So sociologically and politically speaking, to kind of wrap it up here, why should people go see this movie if it's not their musical flair? What's bigger about the story? And again, I think you tell the story so well, but what's so much bigger to take away from this film? And why should people go see it even if it's not their taste?
I think people are interested in process. And I think that's shown by all the television programs that are about how something is made. And even if you don't cook, you can see how, you know, cooking shows or build something, you see how they build a chopper bike or a car. And I think people are interested in process. And that's what the film really looks at, is how this scene was built. And it's very like human stories that I think anybody can identify with. It's never a concert film. So there's not, while there's some scenes of musicians playing, obviously, it usually involves commentary about why this is significant and what it meant in a larger and broader sense. So I think anybody who's interested in music history would be interested in the film. And I think anybody who's interested in the history of how something came together and an energy that came together, I think they might find this film interesting. Of course, I think metalheads would find the most interesting. It's part of their history. It's another segment of something that happened. And I wanted to get in because I think it's really significant to this scene and to how important the East Bay is and the kind of character of the East Bay. There's a story that's told, Ruthie's Inn, again, being this most important place in terms of giving an opportunity to so many bands for them to play. Ruthie's Inn was booked by an African-American man named Wes Robinson. He is gone now, but his daughter's in the film speaking for him, and he is so beloved and well-remembered by everybody. And Wes was certainly from another generation. He grew up listening to jazz. He was a jazz aficionado, and yet he booked all of these thrash bands and a whole load of punk bands, too. And I think his jazz roots allowed him to see and understand that what he was witnessing and what was happening was a cutting edge of music, just in the way that jazz has been and sometimes continues to be this cutting edge of music in a different direction. And I think that is so indicative of just the kind of person that would rise up in the East Bay and have an opportunity and then give opportunity. And I'm so glad that that story is in our film, because it's exactly why we tell this story in the film.
And it's definitely, I would argue, as an historian and someone that deals with issues of censorship and untold histories, Adam Dubin, you've done a stellar job at telling one of those untold histories. It's there. It's mm-hmm. rich. It's vibrant. There are so many different components of it that speak to who we are as people and communities. Again, I just commend you on doing such a stellar job and doing a film on such an important topic that the way that it's done is accessible to anybody who is interested in the bigger and broader pictures and points of life that you just described. So thank you so much again, Adam Dubin, for all of your work. Adam Dubin is a filmmaker. The movie we've been talking about is Murder in the Front Row, which goes through and looks at a history of thrash metal in the San Francisco Bay Area and the significance that it's had in terms of its longevity into the 21st century. And Adam Dubin, your film is going to be playing at the Oakland International Film Festival September 26th. Adam Dubin, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us on the Project Censored Show to talk about this, I would say, really important cultural film that you are sharing.
Thank you, Mickey.
That does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself and Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer, Mickey Huff, and host of the program with co-host Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. The Project Censored Show airs on over 40 stations around the United States from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work or to find any of our previous archive programs, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your cell phone's podcast application. Please feel free to share your feedback about our work. You can contact us through projectcensored.org. Last but not least, thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won. We got the love of the brothers and our sisters. Political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief. Combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we flip our brothers and our sisters. We want to crack.